All right, so this is the fourth episode. Okay.
I guess I missed the other three.
No, you didn't. Did you really?
Yeah.
You're not on any of the other ones?
I don't think so. Because you did it was the Flash of Two Worlds, right? Was that the first
Flash,
one?
yeah, that was the first one. Flash of Two Worlds, and then what the hell was that? 129 was the next one. Flash 129, and then Flash 137.
I don't think I'm in any of those.
Oh, man.
Now we got to do them all over. Scrap them.
Well, you need to be available once in a while.
Hey.
I seriously though, I feel awful about that. I thought you were part of at least a couple of those. Well, I'm glad you're here for this one then, because I didn't want to get to the JLA pro or the JSA proper without you. So
here I am.
We good?
Yep.
All right. And Paul is not joining us, correct?
What does he have to do that's more important is what I would like to know.
I don't know.
This whole family thing, kids, wife, what's wrong with him?
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Born during the despair of the Great Depression, tempered by the fires of the Second World War, on a parallel Earth very much like our own, yet slightly different, they're banded together the greatest forces for freedom ever assembled. Over the many ensuing years, new and younger members would join the veteran champions of the Golden Age, continuing their fight for truth, justice, and the American way. Becoming so much more than just heroes, they became legends. Back to the Bins proudly presents Legends of the Justice Society of America.
Hello, and welcome to Back to the Bins. This is the fourth episode of our new feature, Legends of the Justice Society of America. My name is Scott Gardner, and joining me for this episode is David A. Pascarella.
How's it going?
I'm going great, man. I am really psyched to be talking about this tonight. And joining us, he says for the first time, but I could swear he was part of one of the earlier episodes. But anyway, Dr. Bill Robinson.
Excuse me, I just vibrated in.
Hey, what you do on your own time is, you know, your business. So.
Well, there's a lot of talk about vibrators in this comic.
Yes, there is, and we will be getting into some of that later on.
It's a good thing this is radio and not television.
All right, well, I think we're just going to go ahead and just dive straight into this because we have rather a lengthy synopsis on this. And then I don't know about you guys, but I have copious notes. So I think this is going to be a fun one. This is the big one. This is the moment we've been building up to here. So here we go. So the book for this time is Justice League of America, Volume 1, Number 21. Cover date of August 1963, had an on sale date, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, on June 20th, 1963. Cover price on this one, a mere 12 cents. Cover credits, penciler was Mike Sikowski, and the inker is Murphy Anderson. The cover is rather a legendary cover in DC Comics. It is the one where the Justice League of America is all holding hands around a their meeting table with a crystal ball in the middle of the meeting table, and they're holding a seance, essentially, and mist or fog or smoke or something is coming out of the crystal ball and forming kind of a heavenly image above them, and in that image above them is the classic members of some of the classic members of the Justice Society of America looking down on them and smiling at them. And the cover just reads, "Back after 12 years, the legendary superstars of the Justice Society of America." It says, "Featuring Crisis on Earth 1," which is the name of the story in this, Crisis on Earth 1. The writer is Gardner F. Fox, penciler Mike Sikowski, inker was Bernard Sachs, and the editor was Julie Schwartz. Roll call. The issue didn't have one, but I made one for you. So here we go. Roll call is The Atom, Aquaman, Batman, Flash, Green Arrow, Green Lantern, The Martian Manhunter, Superman, and Wonder Woman. and playing for the Justice Society of America, the Atom, Black Canary, Dr. Fate, the Flash, Green Lantern, Hawkman, and Hourman. Okay, so here's our synopsis on this one. In the secret sanctuary of the Justice League of America, its members meet in an emergency session as the chairman, Batman, speaks to the group of a challenge from a new team of evildoers, the Crime Champions. The bad guy team consists of Kronos, Felix Faust, and Dr. Alchemy. They have announced their intention to rob a sunken ship, a Powers City bank, and a Safeway armored car, and have boasted they will elude the JLA no matter what. The team splits into groups because Silver Age and sets out to lay down some justice, happy in the knowledge that Sucky Snapper Carr is not in this issue. Meanwhile, at this same moment, on a duplicate Earth separated by a different vibrational frequency, a similar organization meets officially for the first time in years, the Justice Society of America. They have likewise been challenged by three of their old foes, the Fiddler, the Wizard, and the Icicle, to try and stop them as they commit a trio of million-dollar robberies. Similarly, they also split into subgroups and merrily skip out the door, happy to be back in action. Chapter 2 begins with Felix Faust playing like Moses and parting the sea with his magical powers in order to loot a sunken ocean liner. He is quote-unquote challenged by Aquaman, the Martian Manhunter, and the Atom, but totally pwns all of them. Along Route 55, Dr. Alchemy lays in wait for the armored truck and seizes the vehicle with his matter transformer. Superman, the Flash, and Green Arrow arrive to stop him, but a telephone pole and fire hydrant converted to kryptonite take out the Man of Steel. A vibrational whammy seemingly shakes the Flash apart, and Green Arrow gets stuck in some glue. Yeah. However, the Emerald Archer cleverly uses his lead-based paint arrows, because why would he not have those, to coat the kryptonite, thus freeing Superman. But it is too little too late as Dr. Alchemy successfully escapes. Meanwhile, Kronos robs a bank in Power City and Wonder Woman, Batman, and Green Lantern show up to apprehend him. The Time Tyrant uses a number of clock-based gadgets and gizmos to evade capture and eventually pulls a fadeaway, leaving the heroes puzzled as to what the hell just happened. We, the readers, follow the villainous trio through space and time to an unsuspected borderland between the two Earths where all six aforementioned bad guys have established a swank set of digs inside a great sphere of a vibratory energy. There's a lot of vibrating going on, as Bill said. This place is great for swingers parties, by the way. There, the Wizard, the Fiddler, and the Icicle tell of how they, too, were successful in their respective heists, having defeated and humiliated their enemies in the Justice Society. Felix Faust becomes the first person ever to use the nomenclature Earth One when thanking the Fiddler for the portable vibrator. Insert your own comment here.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Thanking the Fiddler for the portable vibrator that he gave the JLA villains, which allowed them to escape to this secret hideaway. The Fiddler recalls how lucky it was the day he accidentally discovered the precise pitch on his violin that allowed he and his compatriots to break jail from Earth 2, and how they materialized on Earth 1 and eventually met and formed an alliance with that world's trio of villains. The villains gleefully gloat about how smashingly this supervillain team-up is going and how, by swapping Earths, each trio is finally free to spend their ill-gotten gains with complete anonymity and without fear of reprisal. And, bonus, they manage to capture both Flashes, too, the only two men who might recognize another Earth's bad guys and spoil the scheme. And so the criminals swap Earths and set out to enjoy a life of pleasure and ease. But it ain't but three panels later that the Fiddler, the Wizard, and the Icicle decide that Earth 1 is just simply too ripe for the picking and devise a plan to challenge the Justice League to a showdown, disguising themselves as Kronos, Felix Faust, and Dr. Alchemy, and utilizing an incredibly convoluted plot to get each leaguer to touch a specific magical talisman. Miraculously, this plan goes off without a hitch, and the combined membership of the Justice League of America finds itself trapped within its own HQ with no means of escape. Suddenly, Batman remembers the magical crystal ball given to the team by Merlin in JLA number 2, and through which Felix Faust, well, actually the Fiddler, are you confused yet? Issued his challenge to the team earlier. And so the group actually does conduct a seance. Yes, just like on the cover of the book. Bonus points. And is able to contact the Flash. But he's still trapped within a vibratory bubble at the bad guy's interdimensional honeycomb hideout. So the Scarlet Speedler suggests contacting the Justice Society and summoning them to Earth 1, where they won't be bound by the magic hampering the Justice League. Within moments, the images of the Justice Society are materialized, and an exciting historical first meeting takes place between the two great super teams. Handshakes and introductions all around, and then a game plan is formed. The Earth 2 heroes will stay here on Earth 1 and fight their bad guys while Dr. Fate magically transports the JLA to Earth 2 to round up theirs. The Green Lanterns, meanwhile, travel to the misty borderlands between the Earths in a desperate attempt to find and free the Flashes. To be continued. All right, fellas, what did we think of this one?
There's a lot of flashing, swapping, and vibrating going on.
Well, it is the 60s. Do either of you guys own this issue, or and had you ever read it before?
No and no.
I do not own the issue, but I have read it several times.
Okay. I have this issue fairly recently acquired, although not as recently as our buddy Paul, which sadly could not join us for this episode. Paul just very, very recently acquired his copy, and I've had mine now for, I don't know, 6 months or so. But yeah, I was chasing this one for the longest time, trying to get a copy on the cheap. And I scored it, you know, relatively cheap for the value of the book, but more than I usually will ever spend for a book. But I was really happy to finally track it down, just, you know, for its historical significance and everything. If I had ever read it before, I have no recollection of having read it before. So for all intents and purposes, for me, this was the first time reading it. I kind of dug it. I mean, it's Silver Age wacky, but it's not that like really groany Silver Age wacky like we had on a couple of the Flash tales that we just looked at. More than anything, I thought it was a lot of fun.
Oh, definitely.
Do we just want to kind of go through the book, like page by page? How do we want to cover our notes on this one? I'll leave it to you guys.
I'm fine with going page by page. We can start with the cover.
Okay. What do you think of the cover?
So a lot of hand holding. I mean, it is a seance, but the Batman and Superman handhold looks a little like tender there. I mean, it was like so front and center, and you know, he's probably crushing Batman's hand. Meanwhile, Batman's ready to rip out the Adam's arm, and John Johns is going, "Pull my finger," with him on the other side.
Would you have looked at this as a kid and gone, "Oh my God, the JSA's dead"?
Somebody's dead. They're in a cloud.
That's a good point. Yeah, I had never thought of that. That's a really good point. You know, I feel, I don't know, should I feel foolish that I, all these years, I thought that this was just a representational cover? I really never expected that this moment actually happens in the issue.
Why would you think this was going to happen in the issue?
I was a little confused where it said back after 12 years, a legendary superstars of the Justice Society of America. And then they actually kind of say that inside the book that they've been on hiatus or retirement, because I thought maybe it'd been like publishing time. Was it publishing time, or was it just their Earth 2 time?
Oh, I took it to mean publishing time. I didn't even think of that, Bill.
Yeah, I want to say that we talked briefly about this in one of the prior episodes, but the listeners won't have any sense of this, but to give you a peek behind the curtain, it's been, a couple of months, I think, since we recorded the last episode, so I'm not entirely sure, but I tell you what, let me look that up real quick, because I want to say it's publishing time. I'm almost positive that it's publishing time.
Well, no, because on page 4, when on the second panel, okay, it says, and in this other Earth of J Flash, the Justice Society of America is meeting after a lapse of 12 years.
Right.
So they're saying in their Earth 2 time, they haven't gotten together for 12 years.
Right.
And it says, yes, after more than a decade of inactivity, the old Justice Society of America is meeting once again.
Well, what year was this published again?
63.
And the last issue of All-Star Comics was on sale December 13th, 1950.
Oh, well, maybe. Okay. So they're doing publishing time and Earth 2 time are coinciding. That's pretty interesting.
Right.
It's actually kind of cool.
I'm trying to look that up on Mike's Amazing World, but the problem is that Mike goes in continuity order a lot of times with these things. So when you go, to this issue in Mike's Amazing World, it says the last appearance of them is in the Flash story that we just looked at. So you go to that Flash story, which was Flash 137, and it does say first modern appearance with the exception of a flashback in Flash 129, which, yes, we saw that. Last appearance in Adventure Comics 466, but that's because that's a flashback tale telling of when the JSA quit because they had to go before HUAC and HUAC wanted them to unmask and they refused. So they just quit, which would have taken place sometime in the 50s. But that's a retcon. So, and then if you click on Adventure 466, then it gets screwy because then it says their last appearance was in Justice League of America 172. And, so it just keeps getting weirder and weirder. So, it doesn't default back to whatever their last published appearance was. It's going by some sort of continuity order.
I think you have to go with All-Star Comics 57, cover dated 1951.
So I know that's the last issue of All-Star, but is that the last, is that their last appearance until their reemergence in the Silver Age? See, these are things I feel like I should know, but I just don't.
I'm sorry, I threw such a curveball out there.
No, it's an excellent question. I really wish I knew the answer. I just, in all truth, I've never even read. Okay, so if you go to All-Star Comics number 57, which was the last issue published back, would this still be considered the Golden Age? Yeah, I guess. Yeah, 51. Yeah, this is their last appearance before it says next appearance is Adventure 466 again, which was, again, a retcon that takes place after. So yeah, I guess that was. So, yeah. And that's, yes,
if you go to Mike's, the character appearances, it has All-Star Comics 57. Then the next appearance is Flash 137. Then Justice League 21.
You're right. I forgot he had that feature. Yep, there you go. Yep, you're right.
So it's really, it's 12 years.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's kind of cool. Think about it. At that time, if you were a kid buying this off the rack, And maybe your dad looks at it and goes, hey, I remember the Justice Society.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, by that point, a whole generation had gone by. So, yeah, older, you know, like an older brother or a dad or uncle or something might very well have. Yeah.
Because, I mean, their first appearance is in 1940. So
right.
So you'd be 20-something years later.
Yep. I dig this cover quite a lot. It is goofy, but just knowing that it is actually something that happens in the issue gives me a new respect for it. I think that's really cool. I love Murphy Anderson is just he's one of my favorite artists. He did the inks on this. I wish to God he'd ink the interior as well. You know, that's no slight to the guy that did ink it. What was his name again? Bernard Sachs. I'm not really familiar with him. I have to be honest. I'm just not a fan of Mike Sekowski. I'm trying. I was reading something about
him. Hey, now, I mean, he's only got one eye. Oh wait, that's the wrong Mike. Oh,
that's Mike Wazowski.
Sorry, my bad.
That was a good one. But no, I was reading something about him a while ago on, I think it was in a Facebook group or something where somebody was asking, you know, what's the group think on Mike Sekowski. And it was so split, but there were a lot of people that were like, oh, you know, I really hated his stuff when I was a kid, but you know, then over the years, you know, I've come to really appreciate it and all. But I wonder, you know, did they really, or is that nostalgia talking or whatever? Because I just, hey, his art just, I don't know. What do you guys think of the art in this?
It's, I don't want to use the word primitive, but it's much more simplistic.
Yeah.
Yeah, particularly like you look at John Jones and Batman with that little tiny bat on his chest.
Yeah.
Well, it did. So for some reason, when I was reading the book, I don't know if it was the style of the art. I was reading the dialogue for Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman. And all the heroes, I was in my head, I was doing the voices from the Super Friends cartoon. And I don't know why. I normally don't do that. But I that is what I don't know if because it invoked that look. It's I you know, I had the guy that, you know, the not Adam West. I had the bat. I can't remember the guy's name that voiced him in the Super
Right.
Friends.
Right.
But I was just, that's what I heard. I didn't hear Adam West. I didn't hear, you know, anybody else. I heard those people from the Super Friends.
Yeah, I could see that.
Maybe
yeah.
Because it's a little simplistic in its art, and the early Super Friends were not that, you know, you know, it was a little limited with some of the earlier ones, especially the first season.
The art in this, I mean, the feel of the story is similar to Super Friends, but the art reminds me more of that, what was it, Filmation, I think? That
yes.
Did, yeah, mm-hmm. They did like Superman cartoons and Batman and
Superboy.
Superboy, yeah. Yeah, it really strongly reminds me of that in a lot of ways. You know, I think I mentioned when I read the roll call that they didn't give us a roll call, but they did. There is a roll call in here, which I borrowed, but I always double check the roll call. And I noticed that Batman, who's front and center right there, he is left off the roll call. So I included him on mine, but...
Mm.
And I can't help, whenever I see Batman in this era, and it's, you know, the story actually starts with Batman standing up and addressing the league and everything, just given this era and the art style and everything, I actually was thinking Batman was having the voice. Do you guys remember the Justice League record? Did you ever
yes.
have that when you were a kid? And they run down the roll call, and when they get to Batman, Batman sounds like he's like 75 years old. And then they go, "And Batman," he goes, "Yeah,
Superman
here,
Aquaman
here,
Wonder Woman
here,
Flash
here,
Metamorpho
here,
Plastic Man
here,
and Batman
here,
yeah."
You remember that?
He sounds more like the Joker.
Yes, yes, he does. Yeah, he has like an old man. He sounds like Stan Lee or something. He just has like an old man's voice. It's really funny.
And then you can hear him lighting a cigarette.
Is the Atom in a floaty chair, or is it like stapled to the wall, or how does that work?
It's stapled to the wall. Yeah.
Of the three groups in this book, the Justice League has the crappiest looking headquarters out of all of them. Right?
Well, aren't they? Yeah. They're just in a cave, which is where they're
the quite literally
was.
Slap a little paint on the wall.
I know, right? At least the Justice Society has some nice digs there. You know, they got bookshelves and nice comfy chairs, and that looks like a swinging 60s pad right there.
I mean, even the Crime Champions have a nicer looking place.
Right?
So
where the Justice League is, where they're running off to, you know, and they're talking about Snapper Carr having his classes. It was kind of funny because while I was reading this, Ben came by, who Ben is in college too, and he's like, "Ha, Snapper, what a loser! I already did my finals." I was like, "Yeah, Ben." But in that same picture, Batman looks like he's winded. Doesn't he? It's like,
I'm looking at the same panel, and my note for this one was the bacon triple stack with cheese, official lunch of the Justice League of America.
Maybe for Superman and Batman, they're like, woof.
Yeah, they're everybody. All pretty chunky, man. I mean, look at Green Lantern. I mean, he looks all right from like the chest up, but from the waist down, he's got a lard ass.
Oh, come on. Nobody beats Batman. Look at that. Look at that physique.
Yeah.
Do you think they all travel in a straight line like this all the time? They have really wide corridors in the place.
Well, if they've been eating all those bacon cheeseburgers, I don't think anybody wants to be behind the other one.
Batman looks like he has an umbrella on his chest, not a bat.
he's the Penguin.
I just noticed that the Flash's right glove is miscolored too. It should be scarlet like the rest of him, or orange. It's actually like day glow orange here, but they have it colored yellow. That's weird.
Hmm.
I just wanted to say on the previous page where the Justice Society has the league floating above them. I keep hearing Alan Scott say, "Look at these beatniks all sitting around holding hands. Get a job, hippie."
I just noticed he is kind of drawn. They are kind of drawn older too, right there. I don't think I noticed that before, but they do look, you know, like they've got like age lines on, at least a couple of them have like age lines or something on their faces or something. So it is trying to make them look a little bit more like they would be senior members or something. I think
but
that
not Black Canary.
Yeah, no, she's still, yeah, she looks younger than Wonder Woman.
She's got a lot of hard Amazonian years on her, buddy.
Not the years, it's the mileage.
Is it just me, or is Silver Age Martian Manhunter just friggin' goofy looking?
Yes, he's goofy looking.
He looks like Green Mr. Clean.
He just looks so weird. I mean, I've seen this look where it can look really cool. Like in the, I'm trying to remember who the artist was on it. Was it? I want to say Tom Mandrake, but I can't remember. But there was the John Ostrander series with the Martian Manhunter in the 90s where it looked, you know, he looked pretty cool. You know, it was the same exact outfit and everything, but they kind of retooled his design a little bit. But here he just looks like some ball-headed green freak with, like, body paint or something wearing, I don't know, it's like some weird
S&M outfit,
caper. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it's just really a bizarre look. He just looks goofy.
He looks fine when it gets, I mean, to the 80s, he's got the same outfit, but it looks all right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was a little bit more in the, oh, wait, never mind. I've said too much.
I do like the JSA's pad. I love that eagle thing that's on the that crest with the eagle, because there's a cover to one of the digests. I think it has a Perez cover on it with the JSA that has that same eagle crest thing on it as well. I guess that must be their, is that like their logo or something? I don't know what that is, but it's cool. I've seen it before.
That's cool. I like that.
So the panel where the JSA is running, wow, they're just, it looks like they're all dancing to a different song.
Yes. That's why I said they were they skip out the door, because it does. It looks like they're all like, dum-de-dum-de-dum, just like tra-la-la-la.
It's the village people.
Well, I noticed, backing up just a little bit, when they're sitting in their headquarters there, that same one, it talks about, you know, you're at the bottom of the page and it talks about the duplicate Earths and, you know, being separated by vibrational frequencies and all that. You turn the page and it re-explains it. It gives you two explanations of the same exact thing, just two pages apart, like at the bottom of one page and then the top of the, it's really weird. I'm wondering if that's like an editing mistake. Like,
well, maybe there was a lot of ads in between and they figured you'd forget.
I guess. Yeah, you're right, though. That skipping one is like, we're off to see the wizard. Yeah, it's just
23 skidoo.
Page 5, panel 1. This is the one where the wizard is creating he's separating the water, and then he creates like a stairway down to the ship. Credit where credit's due. That's actually pretty cool. That's a pretty decent shot in an otherwise like not so great art story here, but that's a pretty cool shot. The only problem is that it makes the water where this ship is sunk look like the ship's only like 10 feet underwater. You know, it's not like at the bottom of the ocean or anything.
Why is this a problem that he's taking this treasure? I'm confused. Isn't it salvage?
Didn't Aquaman say something like, oh, I'd help them find the salvage? Well, boo-hoo, buddy.
Oh, you didn't get there in time.
Salvage rights on the sea, on the open sea.
I think he's completely right, Felix. This is his.
Did they sink the ship in order to loot it?
No. I think it was probably a known wreck, I guess. And
right.
He just decided he was going to take it. I was really hoping when he's doing his little rhymes to do his magic, when he said up gold, up cash, I really wanted to have him have a rhyme with ass in there.
Yes, that would be great. And Aquaman can kiss my...
and then he's standing on a little platform, and it reminded me of the Daffy Duck Bugs Bunny cartoon where he, at the end, he's when Bugs opens the clam and there's a pearl in it, and the little tiny Daffy jumps out and I'm rich. I'm happy miser.
Okay. The next page, first panel. This is one of the sillier moments as far as I'm concerned. So again, you've got Felix Faust has split the ocean, right? So he's done the whole Moses thing. So on one of the walls of water, you've got Aquaman riding a marlin or something.
Something like that, yeah.
You've got, it looks like a couple of sharks, a couple of whales, all these different fish and everything.
And they can't do anything.
And this is what Aquaman says. Attack, my brothers of the waves. Stop this wicked man, blah, blah. And he goes on and on. And I just want one of these fish to be like, attack how precisely? He's flying and we're underwater. So
they could jump through to the other side of where the other water is.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, so let's see that. So you know, they get a running start and they jump trying to get Felix. What if they miss? They're gonna land in that gap in the ocean, lay there on the floor of the dry ocean bed and just gasp to death. It's horrible.
It would look like when the roadrunner, the coyote, runs off the cliff and doesn't realize it. And then you see him feel around with his fin and then just drop onto the ship. Boom!
Oh, yeah. So, and that's where he says,
He said, stop this wicked man from stealing money that belongs to the steamship company. Their divers located it. It belongs to them. I'd say, I don't see no divers.
Well, find your keepers, buddy. I want one of the fish to go, what's money?
Right, right.
Clams, moolah, loot, booty.
I watch all this crap on the History Channel, and they're very specific that these treasure hunters keep very quiet because if somebody else comes along, it's theirs.
Last panel of that same page, page six. So it says, as the master of magic utters a suitable incantation, the very air bursts into fireballs, which hurtle down at John Jones. And John, as the fireballs are coming towards him, he goes, I'm losing my Martian powers fast. What? You are a friggin' Martian. How do you lose your Martian powers?
I mean, he just has a fear of fire. It doesn't take his powers away, right? I mean... Well,
it's like kryptonite here.
No, but yeah, right. But I don't, I've never felt, to me, it's just been, he has like a psychological thing. It shouldn't.
Well, I think.
Unless that, it's performance anxiety.
I think that came along later though. I think you're right. But I think that explanation came along later. I think initially fire was like his kryptonite. But I think later the explanation was how it works is that you're right. It is like psychosomatic. But my point is that so if this was Superman and these fireballs were kryptonite, then if Superman said, I'm losing my superpowers, you'd be like, oh, OK, you know, because he's Superman. But this guy, now correct me if I'm wrong, his powers are innate because he's a Martian, right? He's not like a super-powered Martian. These powers belong to every person of his race, right?
That's the way I got it.
So to me, it's like, I don't, it just makes no sense to me. I'm trying to think of something equivalent. Like if I'm out in the hot sun all day long and start to get dehydrated, I don't go, I'm losing my human powers. You know, it's like, what? It's just silly to me.
I'm taking it almost like he's solar powered and the sun has gone away and he just falls out of the sky. Turning to stone. Boom.
And Adam is getting rid of the fire by jumping on it. Why is he not burning his feet?
Yeah.
But we'll let it go.
That's a new way of getting a hot foot.
But the best panel on this page, because I really had to, like, I was scrolling down a little bit at a time. Now blow, Martian Manhunter, as hard as you can. And I'm like, whoa.
And he's got his crotch.
It's right in his face.
Right in.
I know.
John, yeah.
Yep. I was like, wait a minute. And I'm like, oh, okay. All right. I see what he did.
Uncomfortable. Yeah, I know. Right.
Can you show me on the doll where the Martian Manhunter blew you? So they're on Route 55 instead of Route 66.
Yeah. That's goofy.
Who would think the speed limit would change to that?
So he uses his, what the hell did he call it? His Philosopher's Stone, which is a matter transformer. He transforms an armored truck.
He turns its tires into rocks.
Yeah.
And they fly out the locked doors that would keep someone from breaking in.
In two opposite directions.
Right. Right.
Inertia doesn't work like that.
Well, then he goes, now I've transformed the truck's fenders into wings.
With little jet engines,
exactly. So will it fly? And what's the fuel source exactly? How the hell does this work?
Magic!
Yeah, I guess.
Although he doesn't use magic, so yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Joe Quesada. Okay, yeah, this one doesn't make any sense either. Fourth panel, same page, page eight. It's the caption box says, to meet the challenge of the super criminal, comes Superman, Green Arrow, and the Flash speeding into Central City from different directions. Why would that be if they all left from the same starting point? How does that shit work?
They're going to take it by surprise.
Well, I mean, they weren't dispatched like via trouble alert or something. They were all together at JLA HQ. So how can they be coming from different directions?
You ever take a ride anywhere with your wife and get, how come you're going this way? That's how.
Okay, all right, all right. I'll buy that one. Oh, here you go, Bill. I just noticed this. It's been a while. I mean, I wrote this ages ago, so I haven't even been back over these notes in a while. I had a note here. I hear the Super Friends voice of Superman when reading the dialogue on this page for page, I don't know, 10 or 11 here.
I think that's about where it started to kick in for me, too. He altered the molecule nature of the telephone poles, turning it into kryptonite. I'm too close.
Well, speaking of the telephone pole, so what's his name? Dr. Alchemy, on the bottom of page, what page is this? Page 8, uses his Philosopher's Stone, turns the telephone pole to kryptonite. So Superman falls out of the sky. There's a couple of decently drawn panels there where Superman's laying there and he's moaning and groaning because of the kryptonite. Mm-hmm. But then after the third panel of page 9, where the hell did the telephone pole go?
Yeah, I was wondering that too, because then it's only the hydrant that's got him. Although he might have rolled away and wasn't as close to the telephone pole.
Yeah, but the pole and the hydrant are only like, what, like 6 feet apart? And we see a big old aerial shot when Green Arrow is firing his lead arrow. I didn't even make a note about that stupid shit.
His lead paint arrow?
Lead paint arrow. Okay. How many arrows does a standard quiver hold? It can't be that many. I'll give the guy having a boomerang arrow and a rope arrow and a boxing glove arrow and an explosive arrow. But what the hell would you need a lead paint arrow
In all fairness, and I'm not a fan of Green Arrow, perhaps it was just a paint arrow.
He does say, I can fire a paint arrow at that fire hydrant. And back then, I remember as a kid, don't eat those flecks of paint off of your windowsill, little Billy. They're full of lead.
That's right.
And you'll get brain damage. We all grew up with lead paint, and we're just fine.
I don't know. The paint just doesn't taste the same since they took the lead out of it.
But why would you, when you're facing guys like Despero and all the different, why a paint ear? Why tie up?
Because it had lead in it, and there might be kryptonite. You got to think of your teammates.
I guess. I think that's ultimately where I was going, too, is that he had this just in case they encountered kryptonite so he could help. So, I mean, I guess that's nice of him, but maybe Superman needs to carry pouches on his utility belt with some lead paint in it and do it his own damn self once in a while, you know? Why tie up valuable space in Green Arrow's quiver for this?
I got a better question. If Dr. Alchemy can change elements from one to another, why isn't he just making gold? Right? Why are you wasting time with this rubbing? Just turn some wood into gold and you're
done.
Maybe
it's not permanent?
Well, it just has to be permanent enough for you to unload it.
Yeah, that's true. Right. That's true. And then when the hydrant's been covered, it looked like Superman is he right said Fred striking a pose? I'm too sexy for this cape. Sexy for this cape, yeah.
I thought he had gas. Pull my finger. Does it smell?
And then he rips Green Arrow's arm right out of his socket when he pulls him out of that glue. Ah!
See, I heard him saying, to Green Arrow, no, I'm not going to carry you like Lois.
I do kind of like the shot of Green Arrow riding. He's like actually standing on Superman's back.
He's Superman surfing.
Yeah, that's actually kind of cool. I was gonna make guff about the fact that Superman's not fast enough to catch Alchemy before he gets away, but he does have Green Arrow on his back, so maybe he didn't want to like burn his teammate alive through air friction, so that's why he didn't go faster.
Or just knock him off, you know, from wind speed. Wow.
Maybe should have left him behind and just captured him.
Well, left him behind. He could have also wrapped him in his invulnerable cape. We've seen him do that trick before, too, you know, to keep the person, you know, protected or what. But I don't know. Sometimes Superman doesn't think about these things, I guess. I don't know. I didn't really have anything on page 11 unless you guys did.
Is this where Jim Croce came up with time in a bottle? My hourglass with its bottled time will eat the bank.
Somewhere here, I didn't note specifically where it's. Oh, here it is. It's the fourth panel, page 11, with Batman. Kronos uses he shoots the crystal out of a timepiece to cut Batman's bat rope. Whatever. It says razor sharp edge of the watch crystal slices the rope and the Gotham Goliath falls earthward. Gotham Goliath?
That's a new one.
Yeah, I guess. So they're kind of reaching for nicknames at this point.
I like how all the airplanes are just like parked outside the building. Like, I didn't know they hover, all of them.
I know Wonder Woman's can hover, but how could Batman have a hovering jet? Is that a thing?
Because he's a millionaire.
I guess.
He can have whatever he wants.
Now, we talked about this before, too, at the bottom of page 12, how the bad guys know Green Arrow's one weakness.
He's yellow.
That bugs me.
And that Wonder Woman's rope cuts him right in half. It's yellow.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Oh, yeah.
How morbid would that be? It's a twofer now.
Green Arrow's gloves. He's like he's wearing Batman's gloves in those first two panels because they're both blue. They're Batman blue in both of those panels.
I'm so blue.
That's got to hurt, though, wouldn't you think? Because how far has he fallen? And she ropes him right in the bread basket. That's got to, I mean, it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you should say that because working construction for many years, they used to have like belts that only went around the waist to protect you when you fell.
Right.
But there was so many back injuries because of that. So they had to change to do like a five point harness with a D-ring in the back that
right.
Hold you in the center of your back, because if you fell like that, you would have serious organ injury or back injuries falling like that and catching that way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
OSHA. It's no joke.
See, now look at the bottom at the bad guy's headquarters, the Crime Champions. Is that not a swank place or what?
Where does the stairway go?
To heaven?
To heaven.
It must, because unless I'm misinterpreting the art here, it looks like a snow globe. So if you look at the far left corner, right next to the narration box where it says on the rim of the Twin Earths, doesn't it look kind of curved right there? So,
yes. Well, I mean, follow that, upstairs.
You think there's room for an upstairs with that curve?
Maybe.
I don't know. It is cool looking, though. It's very 60s. I like that. That's cool. I like that aesthetic. It looks comfy.
Wouldn't you like to slide down that railing?
Whee!
And land on the couch. It's perfect. Poof.
They got a TV built right into the wall. That's pretty cool. At least I presume that's a TV. That's pretty cool.
The wizard's throwing bats, wood, chairs, dressers, trees. Ah!
If it's wood, I'll throw it at you.
I stopped at Home Depot. I'm going to throw a handful of wood dowels at you.
Man, Hawkman needs to hit the gym, too. Look at him.
Especially after all them feathers has been blown away.
But Hawkman's probably 60 years old here, so. It's all right. When you're 60, would you wear an outfit like that?
Oh, God. Yeah, it occurs to me. So you see this thing here. It's actually not bad on the art, although the face is a little weird. But where our man gets frozen in a block of ice. And it occurs to me that people get frozen in ice blocks a lot in the comics. Yet you rarely, you know, there's rarely a threat of suffocation even mentioned. And that always kind of bugs me a little bit. So our man's more concerned with being stuck so long that his hour of power is going to run out. But he's seemingly not concerned about his air running out. That just seems odd to me. I never realized that it was the villains who came up with the Earth designations. I thought that was kind of cool.
That's why they're backwards.
Ah, that's a good explanation for that, too. Yeah, that's a good no prize for that. So you've got where the where Kronos, Felix Faust, and Dr. Alchemy assume their disguises here, and I'm having trouble keeping them straight. Which one's supposed to be what? But right, the second panel, right in the middle of page 18, there it looks like he's disguised as Groucho Marx.
You know what would have been great? Now I'm going to test you to see how you remember your history of Earth 2. They come to Earth 1 to spend this money they've stolen, right?
Right.
And they said, you know, based on the exchange rate, if we take Republic of Quebec money, we'll get a lot more dollars for it.
Uh-huh.
Well, the Republic of Quebec is only on Earth 2.
Right.
And a joke fell flat.
Did they say that? Because I'm looking for words.
No. I said.
Okay. I got you. I'm sorry.
That would have been funny. They get here and they have no money to spend.
Well, I mean, I wonder how close are these two Earths? Like, would the money be the same? Like, would the same presidents be on the same, you know, the same? Well, they're not all presidents, but you know, the same figures be on all the money and everything. Well, you know, because I thought there were supposed to be subtle differences between the two Earths as well, right?
Right. They're subtle ones. And that's really the only one I could think of is that Quebec's an independent country.
Right. There's other ones, too, but I'm blanking on what they are. But I know every once in a while that one would pop up in a story, usually a Roy Thomas story, but I'm blanking off the top of my head. But, yeah, you're right.
Well, you know, it's like we've often said, you know, the Justice Society stayed in retirement all this time. It's like, well, why didn't they come out, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis or something? Maybe right. There was none.
Yeah, that's true. So you've got a moment where Wonder Woman hurls her magic lasso at Kronos, and she says, now that I've got my magic lasso around you, Kronos, I'll order you to obey me. He says, the time isn't ripe for my capture, Wonder Woman. He says, the next moment, Kronos yanks the lasso and slams Wonder Woman against a wall. And she says, merciful Minerva, the lasso refused to obey me, and, oh, I knocked the moose head off the wall. He says, haha, not really being Kronos, I was not forced to obey Wonder Woman's command. What?
So if she hadn't used his name, she'd be all right. You're going to obey my command.
I'm pretty sure that's not how the magic lasso works. I don't think she has to. I don't know. What do you think of that? I call BS on that.
Unless you know, she specifically says it's for the lasso obeys her commands, and she's saying Kronos. I mean, I guess the lasso knows it's not Kronos. I don't know. It's a murky.
Yeah.
Do you know what that is?
It's comic logic. So
that reminds me of Johnny Thunder's Thunderbolt and these old ones I'm reading now. Where if he's not really specific, or if he's in another country and he says, say you, oh, nope, that's in English. I'm in Panama now. You need to speak Spanish.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, I just finished one. They were in Cuba. And he says, oh, no, you got to say it in Spanish here.
What?
I'm just relaying the news.
Wow.
The issue that came out in February 1942. That's the plot.
See, the thing with Johnny where he has to be specific or you know, the command is open to interpretation by the Thunderbolt. I kind of like that as a story mechanism, as long as it's not really stupid or something. This here, I don't know. That just, I don't know enough about Wonder Woman from this era to know for certain, but this just reeks to me of plot convenience as opposed to, you know, how her lasso actually functions most of the rest of the time. You know what
I
mean?
But I also thought the lasso made you tell the truth. So you would think he'd be like, oh no, I'm not Kronos.
See, I thought that basically anybody captured in the lasso was, you know, that's it. You know,
that's the way it worked for Linda Carter.
Right.
So that must be right. Music.
So on page, my last note's way toward the end of the story here, where the Flash, so they hold their little, well, this is before they hold their seance, where they actually contact the Flash through the crystal ball, and he proposes his idea of summoning the Justice Society to Earth One, and he says they won't be bound by the magic that hampers you. How does he know that? He really doesn't know that. Isn't it just as likely that both teams could wind up trapped in the Justice League headquarters?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I thought that was a bit of a stretch.
So I was trying to look at everybody's hands when they're around the crystal ball, and you've got Wonder Woman is holding. Almost like there's an extra set of hands here. Unless they just didn't color John Jones's hand
John's
green.
John's hand is incorrectly colored.
Because I was like, wait a minute. All right. So she's holding Green Lantern's hand because it's a white glove. And he's holding Aquaman's hand, which is green. And Aquaman's. So it's like, yeah, they didn't color his hand. It was like, there's an extra hand here. What the? And then. On the last page, woof, that is a beefy Superman. He's large and in charge.
Yes, he is. Look how tiny Batman is in comparison to him, though. That's weird looking. It's like Bat Boy. I guess it's supposed to be like a perspective shot, like they're further away, but it looks odd. Yeah, it looks very odd.
So... I guess they're held in there by a magical barrier because I guess everybody else just walked out the door.
Yeah.
I guess. No, wait a minute. Because Green Lantern was able to go get away. Wait, how does Green Lantern? What, he got out through the seance globe with the other Green Lantern because they're going to rescue the Flashes in the area in between?
Oh, you're making my head hurt.
Well, yeah, wait a minute. With the magical help of Dr. Fate, the Justice League, that's right. They were shifted to the headquarters of the Justice Society where they could get out. That's right.
That's right.
Okay. Never mind. I answered my own question. I didn't pay fully attention.
See,
no, it is a little confusing. Yeah, they switched Earths and that's right. They got free. Yeah.
That top panel, John Jones looks like he's admiring the eagle and Batman's giving him an appraisal on it.
Doesn't it look like John's wearing a mask, though? It doesn't, the way it's drawn, it doesn't really look like, I don't know, it looks funny. It looks like he's wearing a mask as opposed to that being his actual head.
He doesn't want to be recognized on Earth, too.
Wasn't it in the comics that Speedy lost an arm?
Speedy? Oh yeah. You know what? Now that you mentioned, yeah, I think
so. We're foreshadowing that Green Arrow has no, you know, his like arm is obviously his arm's just folded up because you don't see his red glove. It's like
right.
So,
Dr. Fate looks like he fell instead of he's flying.
Whoops!
And. Adam and Hawkman are just huge.
How can that guy get off the ground?
Look at that.
With those little tiny wings.
Into the Hulk or something. He's just.
Yeah, we're going to stop at the Shoney's on the way in.
Well, what did we think of the first chapter of this?
That was fun.
Mm-hmm. It is fun.
I do think the Champions of Crime is a bit of misnomer, you know.
We are the champions of crime, and we won't do our time, my friends.
It's a great concept. It really is.
With the choice of villains, though, I mean, these guys could be a powerhouse. It's just that, I don't know. It's funny to me when you get characters like this that actually have really cool powers, that have a cool gimmick that could be powerful, but yet they remain morts. And just about all these guys do, unfortunately. At least during this time, anyway. Kronos looks really bizarre. He almost looks... He looks like he's wanting to do blackface, but he's doing whiteface. It's really weird the way his color scheme works and everything with that goofy mask.
He looks like Baron Sunday's type of face in
in Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die, right?
Right.
Don't you feel good about 7-Up?
Yeah, do you remember those commercials?
I think first I saw that guy first in the 7-Up commercials and then in the James Bond movie. And I was like, hey, it's the 7-Up guy.
Right.
Not afraid of him.
Yeah, that's where I knew him from as well. First letter in the letters column is actually from Don Thompson. That's actually pretty cool. You guys remember Don Thompson?
I do not. I don't have the letters page.
I don't either.
Yeah, he and his wife, Maggie, they were the founders of the Comic Buyer's Guide.
Oh.
Which I used to read a lot in the 80s and 90s. So this particular story has been reprinted a good number of times because this is considered a classic. This is the return of the Justice Society, the first crossover with the Justice League and everything. So you can find this story in, here's the rundown. You've got DC 100 Page Super Spectacular, number 6 from 1971. Greatest Team-Up Stories Ever Told Hardcover, 1990. That was also available in a trade paperback same year. Justice League of America Archives, Volume 3 Hardcover from 1994. Crisis on Multiple Earths, Volume 1 Trade Paperback, 2002. DC 100-Page Super Spectacular Replica Edition, number 6 in 2004. Showcase Presents Justice League of America, Volume 2 Trade Paperback, 2007. Justice League of America Omnibus, Volume 1, Hardcover, 2014. Justice Society of America, A Celebration of 75 Years, Hardcover, 2015. Justice League of America, The Silver Age, Volume 3, Trade Paperback, 2017. Crisis on Infinite Earths, Box Set, Hardcover, 2020. And Crisis on Multiple Earths, Crossing Over, Trade Paperback, in 2021. So wow. A lot of reprints of this particular one. You want to do grades?
Why not? I'll go first. The cover, it's so iconic that even though it's wacky, it's become so iconic. And it brings, you know, the characters of the Justice Society back after the absence, as we've determined, of 12 years. Even at the time, I think this would have been an iconic cover. You know, sitting on the newsstand, it would have been as iconic then as it is now. And for that reason alone, I think it's an A cover. The story, it's wacky. It's a little strange, but it's of the time. And it does come up with a convoluted way of bringing the two teams together for the first time. And for those reasons, I'm going to give it a B plus. The art, again, it's of the times, but even of those, the time that it was published, I think it's ultra simplistic compared with, you know, other things that were out there. And for that reason, I would give the art on the interior, I give it a C+, if I'm being honest. But the overall grade's an A+, because it's such an iconic issue, and it trumps everything else.
I think I pretty much agree with Dave on all points. The cover is an A. The story is a B from Bombastic. And like a C+. It's a little simplistic, but it still gets the job done, and it's still an A book overall, because the grades don't matter.
Yeah, I think I'm going to mirror exactly that. I really enjoy this cover. I'm not usually much for Mike Sikowski, but I think that Murphy Anderson really shores him up here and makes this a truly iconic cover. It's very colorful. I mean, with all the different colors going on here, it could be just kind of a visual mess, but it actually works really well. It's nicely staged, and I think it's a great and very iconic cover that has been homaged a lot of times. I dig the story. It's goofy, it's wacky, but if you take that into account, it still works. It's still fun. And really, the only shortcoming for me with the whole thing is the art, but it's not top to bottom terrible. There are some really terrible moments in the art, but there's some decent ones too. There's some of the figure work. I mean, I can see where the guy, he had skills as far as layout and that sort of thing. It just needed some refinement. It probably needed a stronger inker, I'm thinking. But there are some portions and some figure work that I really like, along with the ones that I think are absolutely terrible. So it's this weird... It's this weird blending of the two, honestly. But, you know, the art's really the big thing that comes up short. But overall, I mean, still, you know, for its historical significance and everything, I mean, I'll give this book a huge pass, you know, for any of those other shortcomings. So, yeah, it still comes up as an A book. This was a hell of a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this. And I'm very curious to see where the story goes from here, because I don't think I've read the next issue yet, or if I have, I've forgotten it already. But probably it goes without saying that next time we're going to look at the conclusion of this story, Justice League of America, Volume 1, Number 22, also from 1963.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.